This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, delivering specialty foods and ingredients right to your restaurant, bakery, and bar. Learn more at parisgourmet.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Beber bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
So I showed up at 5:30 in the morning. I actually worked all day. They kept telling me to go home, and I kept telling them, I only got one day. I'll be here. And then, you know, oh, well, now we're just going to clean down. You're welcome to go anytime you want. No, I'll clean down with you. And I stayed until I got there at the beginning and I left at the end of the day. And that was really important to me because I only had one day.
That is pastry chef Milton Abel II of Anderson and My Yard in Copenhagen and the subject of the short film That's My Jazz, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am here with, for the second week in a row, Caitlin Friedman. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning, Andrew.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am dying.
I know. The allergies are bad.
I woke up this morning, and before I had even achieved consciousness, I mean, people can hear this. It's going to be a short intro.
Yeah.
The pollen is, there was that M. Night Shyamalan film.
Yeah, The Happening.
The Happening, and it turned out, sorry, spoiler alert if anybody cares, but
yeah.
It turned out it was like trees were the villain or something like that.
Yeah, well, actually, humans were the villains and the trees were getting back at them.
Yeah, well, touche trees, because I am dying. I mean, it looks like I just found out somebody died. Like, like water's pouring out of my eyes.
Yeah.
I can barely talk. I'm fighting to not have to blow my nose on the air. I'm sorry, listeners. This is horrible. What did people do before Claritin? And
I think they just suffered.
It's horrible.
I kind of liked it because I woke up this morning with this crazy, like, I don't know what this tone is in my voice, but I don't know.
Husky.
Husky.
Sound husky. You have a pack-a-day voice.
I'm going to stick with it.
That is what
for
I call.
As long as we have this horrible pollen.
That is what I call a pack-a-day voice. Which is unhealthy, but it is a sexy sound.
Yeah.
Caitlin.
Yeah.
Well, our guest today, I should say, is Milton Abel II.
That's a great name.
Not Junior. The Second. We'll explain why he goes by that in the show.
Okay.
It's very deliberate. It's very charming. I love this guy. I never met him before. We have a lot of people in common. He came up in... got very well at Per Se and the French Laundry, spent time at NOMA in Copenhagen. He now has a bakery or a patisserie in Copenhagen that's paired with a coffee brewery. It's one business. It's called Anderson in My Yard. He's also the subject of a film, a short film, that had its premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival called That's My Jazz. And it's the story of Milton and of his father, who was a legendary jazz musician and singer.
That sounds kind of great.
Yeah, it's a really terrific short film. It's already showed at the festival. I would have aired this sooner, but we were on our between-season hiatus. So I couldn't air it until now, but it's a great interview regardless. And I hope this film will find its way onto some kind of on-demand or streaming availability or make the festival circuit or something. So if you have a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. I also wanted to say, Kate, we haven't done this in a while, but we've had some good dining experiences lately. Our old friend Rocco DiSpirito has returned. A lot of younger people may only know Rocco from television. How can I keep talking like this? I'm sorry. I'm surreptitiously tending to my...
Can I just pick it up?
Go ahead, Caitlin.
So Rocco's at the Standard Grill now.
Yeah.
And we could not be happier because he is one of our absolute favorite chefs. He's so talented.
Yeah.
And having him back in the kitchen made us really, really happy.
Yeah.
His food is always spectacular.
Yeah, it's tremendous. Just great. So that was an experience we had.
Yeah, that was a great one.
I recently went to Narcissa.
As did I.
As did you, separately. Now, people may remember, at the beginning of the year, Angela Di Maiuga, who's now involved with the Standard Hotel as the, I think, director of food and culture. One of the restaurants under her auspices is Narcissa at the Standard in the East Village in New York. The chef there is Chef Max Blockman. I hope I'm saying that right, Max. Max Blockman Gentile. Gentile. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. But he does a dish there. It is a whole branzino with a habanero beurre blanc.
Yeah, I went with people that ordered this dish and they loved it.
On my recommendation.
Yeah, and I had the morels, which I really... No, Hen in the Woods.
Yeah.
And also roasted... the vegetables are really good because the roasted cauliflower as a main was... It was just so satisfying.
Yeah. Well, this branzino dish, I wrote to everybody involved with the restaurant the next morning. It's amazing. You have to like spicy food to eat it. But I said to somebody, I said, like, Jean-Georges in his prime would have been happy to have made that dish. It's beautiful. It's delicious. The spice is perfect. The fish was perfectly cooked. So bravo to you, Max, for that dish. It's just killer. And then we had a Cinco de Mayo celebration last night. We went to Empeyo. You're glaring at me.
I'm not glaring at you.
We went to Empeyo Midtown, Alex Stupak's restaurant, with some friends.
I love the food there.
They had a special menu. It was really cool. Instead of like socking everybody with a special prefix menu, they went the other way. It was like a menu of snacks, tacos, small plates, no entrees.
Which was perfect, because then you just could have tons of tacos, which were great.
And just hang out.
Yeah.
And we had a great time, couple of rounds of margaritas.
Yeah.
And as you remember, I had a glass of red wine.
I remember that so well. Because guess where that glass of red wine ended up, everybody?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I gestured at one point in the evening, knocked over my red wine,
yeah,
and it went all over you.
Yes, and people, I was wearing a white shirt. So it's like, and it wasn't just like a little bit. It was like almost half a glass, if not more, of red wine down my pants.
It
was like in my chest, down my pants.
It was terrible.
In my shoes.
It was terrible.
It was terrible.
You did a magic thing. You went to the restroom.
Yes, and I cried.
Did you cry?
No, I didn't cry.
You came back.
I wanted to cry, but I didn't cry.
You came back with your white blouse.
Yeah.
There was not a scintilla of red remaining.
You're making a joke.
But it was completely
soaked. Yeah, that was great.
So from a distance, you probably looked totally normal to people.
No, I'm sure I didn't.
Are you actually still mad about this?
No, I'm just, you know. It just was one of those, I'm sure everyone knows, it's just one of those things where it was like an event. And it was just a little bit, tiny bit hard to get past it because I was really uncomfortable. But the food, getting back to the food, which is the most important thing.
No, I think the most important thing is that you were angry about this all night. But yeah. Accidents happen.
I know. Well, it wasn't like I was angry
everyone
at you.
Listening to this has like, had a moment where they've either knocked something over or been the victim of a knocking over.
Yeah, either way, it's not good, but it's fine. I wasn't furious. I just was uncomfortable. But the food was really good, and the company was amazing, and I love the friends that we went out with. So it ended up being like, it was a really good night.
Okay. Well, I wanted to share those dining experiences. I should say none of the people we're mentioning are you know, they're not sponsors. They didn't pay for this. We had some great dining experiences recently, and we wanted to share that with people because there's a lot of food out there these days. Anyway, Caitlin.
Yeah.
With that, I don't know that I need to say anything more about our guest, but again, this is an interview I did about a week ago with Milton Abel II. He was in New York to attend the screenings. I think there were five of them at the Tribeca Film Festival, which runs over a period of weeks here in New York City at various venues. He is the subject and star of the short film That's My Jazz, directed by Ben Proudfoot. He grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and this is mainly, the film is mainly the story of him and his dad and his own relationship to fatherhood. And as you learned in the movie, I don't think we actually say this in the interview, he has stepped away from restaurants. The reason he now has this sort of bakery coffee concession, which is getting ready to open its second location, was to create a life for himself where he had normal hours so he could be home on a relatively normal schedule, what to most civilians is a normal schedule, with his kids and his wife. That's why he stepped away from the restaurant world. Anyway, we talk about that in the interview as well. And with that, I'm going to now send it over to my interview with Milton Abel II. Here you go.
Do you like Milton or Milt?
Milton.
Milton.
Milt was my dad.
Milt was your dad. Even though you have the junior, that was your...
That's it. And right. My mom's like, the second. No one knows who Junior is. She's she put it on my birth certificate, actually, as the second.
The sec with Roman numerals?
With Roman numerals.
Really?
Because...
How royal.
Yeah. You know, they say the same thing in Denmark as well. The woman laughed at me when I went to get my name registered. She's like, who is this guy?
So you maintain that. You respect that.
Yeah, because everybody was pretty old when I was born. My dad was 55, and all of his friends were that age or older. And she didn't want people running around saying, oh, hey, Junior. She wanted them to call me Milton because that was just important. That's dad's name.
Yeah.
That's my name.
Yes.
That's why she named me that way.
Yeah.
So it's a little weird to call somebody, hey, the second.
Yeah, right. So that was her, like, that was a roadblock.
She's a smart woman. Smart woman.
Okay. So obviously you're the center of this new movie that we're going to talk about in a minute. I'm sure, described this in the intro, but the movie is, it's not a very long film. It's about 15 minutes long.
Exactly.
It's a short Reader's Digest version of your path to the kitchen, and also your relationship, I would say, with your dad and also with fatherhood.
Absolutely. I think it really, the best way I've heard it described, and the way I like to say it as well, is it's a lot about the sunrise of my career and the sunset of my father's life.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. So let's first talk about your life, if we could.
Yeah.
First of all, is it weird? I mean, you've been in the public eye for a little while, but to see yourself, you know, on a movie screen, to have your life there, you talk about some very personal, you talk about life and death and about, you know, fatherhood's for a lot of guys a very loaded issue.
Yeah.
Just seems to be the case. Yeah. Is it weird for you to have so many people like watching your story the way they are?
Yeah, a little bit unexpected. When they were making this film, I had no... I'm just asking myself, who am I? Who am I?
Right.
Why are they... What are they going to get out of this?
Yeah.
Where is this going to go? What's this going to be?
Right.
You know, people ask... My mom asked me, my wife asked me, you know, what are they going to do with this? Do you know what's going to happen or this? I said, I have no idea. I'm just... You know, I just showed up and I talked and we just took it from there.
How did you know the filmmaker?
I met him. We were introduced to each other.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking to make a film called A Love Letter to Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of, I don't know how to describe their work normally. I would say it's do things for big companies.
Okay, right? Like industrial stuff?
Yeah, stuff like that. And that's, I think, a part of their repertoire, what they do. And he loves, Ben Proudfoot, the director, he loves to do like a side project when they're off on location. So they were in Copenhagen. They had been in Lisbon before, and they made a film called Love Letter to Lisbon.
Mm-hmm.
and that was like their passion project that they did there. So they booked a couple extra days while they were in Copenhagen, and they were, well, let's do Love Letter to Copenhagen. And I was just going to play a small part in that, like just, you know, make something to represent the food aspect of Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. I was opening a small coffee roastery with my partners called Anderson and Maillard.
Mm-hmm. Great name. I want to talk about that name.
Yeah.
I want to find out later why you surrendered your name to a scientific word.
I'd say...
but we'll get to that.
I think that plays to my humility, maybe. Yeah. But they wanted to make this love letter to Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And just going to play a small part, just make some food and represent Copenhagen. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were having a hard time getting Danish people to open up on camera. It's January. It's dark. It's been dark. It's cold. People are just, you know, they're not going to be super open during that time of the year.
Yeah.
It's actually quite a change when the sun comes out of Copenhagen during the winter and mm-hmm. Copenhagen during the summertime.
Yeah.
And so they just, they were having a difficult time. When we met in this cold, dark, really not much, no electricity, construction site of a cafe, coffee roastery, bakery. And I think Ben was wondering, why am I meeting this American chef in Copenhagen? You know, that sort of thing. We started talking, and he asked me my story. How the hell did you get here?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I can't start my story without talking about my parents, my mom and my dad, and how much they gave me. And then I had such a special childhood, had to start there. And then he left the meeting. He said, you know, we're not making Love Letter to Copenhagen. We're making a film about this guy. And I mean, that just blew me away.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned your wife's sort of, I don't know if it was skepticism or concern. You know, there's always this thing when somebody wants to film something, especially in the last 15, 20 years with reality television. Like, are they going to try to make it melodramatic? Are they going to look for, you know, are they going to look for, you know, scandal? Are they going to look, you know, all that? Was there like a trust? Did they have to earn your trust? Did you just have a good feeling right off the bat?
I just had a good feeling right off the bat. And I just try not to think too much when I was doing the interview,
mm-hmm.
you know. And Ben had this setup with the camera so that his face was in the lens. So I wasn't looking at a piece of equipment. I was looking into his eyes.
Really?
Yeah. He was doing the interview. He was sitting off to the side.
Yeah.
But his face was in the lens.
Is that something he devised? I've never heard of that.
One of the producers said to me, it's a lot easier to not do that. So the fact that you found that to be not disarming, but yeah, just made everything really comfortable.
Yeah.
He said that's the reason they do it. You know, it paid off.
So it wasn't all that different from like the way you and I are sitting and I here just, across the table.
Exactly right, man. I'm just talking to you. You know, I had done some things before for Vice. I had done some things before for like Munchies and things like that.
Yeah.
So, and I just couldn't have told the same. I couldn't have said it the same way if I was just looking into a cold piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking in this guy's eyes. He's just talking me through it, asking me all the questions. And Ben and I really, I think we worked really well together straight away. We clicked. Like, mm-hmm. To sound cliche, it just really was, okay, we just started flowing.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, most of these things I've never said out loud to anyone.
Anyone?
No, not my family, not my mother, not my sister, no one, you know, and I just took it as an opportunity to I don't know who's going to see this. I didn't really know, so just, and I'm never going to see them, so to hell with it. Just say what you want to say, and it just all kind of came out.
How long was the actual interview?
It was like 6-8 hours.
Yeah.
Like we just sat there in this cold. I mean, this place is cold. Like you can see my breath.
You did it in one day?
One day. One solid seating for the interview.
So,
And I felt so bad. Federico Conforti, the editor, man, he had his work cut out for him after that. Because I was probably all over the place and this and that and the other. And, you know, I could go off on a tangent, but he pulled it together just great.
Well, to me, that means that somebody's actually really thinking in a live way. You're not getting canned answers, you know? Did this kind of, you say you'd never said this stuff out loud to anybody, did it sort of allow you to process elements of your life in a way that was like therapy, do you think?
I think it's more, you could say that, or you could call it a release.
A release, to hear it out loud.
I think these things all the time. They drive me. I have the regrets.
Right.
Deeply.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't take it back.
Yep.
You can't do it any differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if they're always racing in your head, they're always racing in your head. Like, they do. They really do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say them out loud, maybe they'll stop just being inside you all the time.
Mm-hmm. And maybe not seem quite as... When stuff's inside, right, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah. And often out of all proportion to reality.
And it just gets a little bit less heavy.
Yeah.
Or maybe having a stranger smile, nod.
Right.
Understand.
Yes.
Feel for you.
Yes.
Relate.
Yeah.
That helps a lot.
Okay. You know,
somebody else shares that same...
Mm-hmm.
Those same feelings. There's somebody else in the world who shares these same regrets, has had these same experiences, has done the same thing I have, or and more.
Yes.
And, you know, they're out there. And it just makes you not... Then it doesn't feel so like such a big deal.
Right. Okay. So let's... I don't want to spoil the film for people, right? But, you know, what's the old Miles Davis line? The notes you don't play are just as important as the ones. I want to talk about the notes that aren't played in the movie.
Okay, cool.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I'm going to obliquely refer to stuff that happens in the movie.
Sounds great. I'll try not to give it away, too.
But talk about some of the stuff that's in there. I mean, we'll talk about it, but we'll be a little abstract and all that. Okay, first of all, it's called That's My Jazz. Your father was a legendary jazz musician. Do we say and singer?
Yeah, yeah, you could say that for sure. Jazz musician, jazz bassist.
Yeah,
singer,
but he also did
front man.
He did. They show it in the movie. He did things with his voice.
He did it all, man.
That was almost percussive, I would call it. It wasn't like he was singing a tune, but he was he was harmonizing with what he was playing.
He was a fantastic singer as well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most impressive things he did was his scatting.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. He'd scat, and he and the bass would sing the same notes at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd be moving up and down the bass, playing, and just singing the exact same notes he was playing simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they were just the same unit. Just performing, just singing together, flawlessly.
Yeah,
and I don't know if you anybody who's played an instrument, singing and playing at the same time is just so hard.
Mm-hmm.
When I used to play, I used to have to look at my hands in order to sing and play, and it would still just could never do it.
Yeah,
and this man just did it effortlessly.
Interesting.
And he had a fantastic voice. He sang for. I used to sing the Star Spangled Banner at different events in Kansas City as well, which is a really tough tune to sing as well,
mm-hmm.
really wide range.
Yep.
So as well as being a great bass man, he was a great singer as well.
Great. So at what point in life, you talk in the movie about, you're like a stage kid.
Yeah.
Kind of like an army brat.
Bar baby.
Yeah, baby, that's the term.
That's what my mom
where
mom
you got pointed. You got like brought around, you've talked about falling asleep on the stage.
Oh.
So that was just your life, right? At what point did you become aware of, you know, that just not that this wasn't a usual life, right? That you were in the middle of this very special thing. And B, that your dad wasn't just he was your dad, and you talk in the film about the fact that he was able to do this rare trick of being both a performer, you know, a very dedicated performer and being, you know, a present father. But when did you get a sense of who he was? Like, do you remember what age you were or what it was that brought that home to you?
No, I honestly can't remember. I think maybe it wasn't until I reached more into my teenage years or more of an adult that the real gravity of who he was hit me.
Yeah.
But he was always... I mean, we were just one unit, you know, and Dad and I started playing together. I learned to play piano, and we had our first gig together when I was six, turning seven that summer. Wow. At the youth stage in the Kansas City Jazz Fest. That was like 1992. We played together as a piano-based duo until I was around, I think, 12 years old, something like that. And so then we were something together, you know. You know,
right.
But I did not realize how much of a life my father had before me, I think, until I reached adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
Until I could really, yeah, mm-hmm. until I reached adulthood.
Was there a name to that duet?
Him and I were, yeah. We were Milt and Milt too. There you go.
What was he like as a collaborator? I mean, he was your dad. You were a kid.
Yeah, he was good. He my parents were the ultimate enablers, ultimate encouragers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to do this? Okay, we'll do this. Let's mm-hmm. get lessons. You want to do lessons? Okay.
He didn't teach himself. You got
no.
An instructor.
I had a great man. I had my classical piano teacher was, her name was Mila Portman.
Mm-hmm.
And then my jazz guy was another jazz legend named Russ Long.
Okay.
And I'd go over his house. He'd write charts for me.
Yeah.
He put the songs in a key that I could play them in, and kind of made them in a way where a six-year-old could play them,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we'd do some practicing together, and then we'd go home. Dad and I'd go home and play together.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it came. And then you know, if you just wanted to, you know, it takes a lot. You gotta go to lessons. There's so many logistics to it. Get picked up, get dropped off.
Listen, my daughter plays my daughter's 14. She plays four instruments, and it's like
incredible.
And when she doesn't practice, it shows.
Yeah,
you know, I sit in. She's doing drums now, but I sit in on her lesson, and you know, if she's practiced every day versus, you know, practice really hard for 2 hours at the day of the lesson.
Exactly. There's a big difference.
No, you can't fake it. You cannot fake the hours.
And you got to go, there's a lot of things to it. So
yeah.
They just made sure that if we wanted to do something, we could do it.
Right.
You know, when I was in third grade, my mother saw that there was an audition for the Missouri Repertory Theater for A Christmas Carol, which mm-hmm. is like their seasonal Christmas show. And she says, "Oh, you want to try this?" And I had been slowing down the piano a little bit. So you want to try this or whatever. You know, let's see how it goes.
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, I'll try that." I said, "What do I have to do?" And of course, it says in the paper, you know, needs a 1 minute monologue.
Yeah.
Well, she just I had none of that and no training or anything. She mm-hmm. just said, "Just get up there and talk about yourself for 1 minute." And that's, you know, that's it. She took me to the audition. I took a timer with me.
Okay. Like
set it for 1 minute. Set this timer down.
Did you like stick the landing and have an ending?
Man.
Or did you just
exactly.
stop talking?
Stick the landing, put the foot back.
But did you have an actual ending or did you just stop?
No, I just talked to myself. They,
and
at
then
the
just
end
stopped.
Of it, I remember at the end of it, they asked me to, tell a joke.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember what that joke was. Probably very terrible, but, you know, that's it. I didn't get the part.
Okay.
But I was also very young, and so then when I got out of there, my mom asked me, "Oh, did you like that? And how'd you feel?" And I said, "Oh, it's great, you know." And do you want to do that? Well, yeah, we could try that, Yeah, I want to do that. Okay. And then the next time I was in, or not too long after that, I was in acting lessons. She got me acting lessons. I took acting lessons for a very, very long time. Cold reading classes. All this, you know, she just got me into it, and we started doing it.
Were you good?
I was all right.
Did you think
I was all
you were
right.
You had a natural.
I think just in general, it. I was all right. You know, I could. I was all right. I wouldn't say. You know, you know, just so young. So how much can you expect out of a fourth grader or a fifth grader or a sixth grader? But as I started to get older and let myself go, I remember I played a human, like a kid, for a couple roles. Like, you know, always played, you know, you always play a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got this role as Sam I Am in this thing called Green Eggs and Ham. It
mm-hmm.
was a mixture of an opera. We had an opera singer.
Okay.
And it was just two two-person cast.
Okay.
An opera singer and me. And I played Sam I Am, and the opera singer was the, you know, the person who does, or the thing that doesn't like green eggs and ham.
Yeah.
And it was a jazz opera. Everything was written by Robert Capello, the composer. And that was the first role where I didn't play a human being. And I realized that this is not me on stage. This is not me on stage. This is something else. This is a character. I'm not playing a human being. I'm not a kid. I don't have to be cool. I don't have to be anything. I'm just this thing.
Right.
And that made things click. Like it was just like a moment, an awakening.
An epiphany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then from that point on, I was a lot better.
And were you better in, like, were you like a methody person who would get in, like, come up with like a backstory for your character? Or would you just kind of get a vibe and just go with it?
I just approach it with innocence, I think.
Yeah.
You know, just approach the role with innocence and just go from there. And I think that's what, you know, I did well. I got a lot of roles, and I did that until I was 21 years old.
Really?
Yeah. And so, you know, musical theater and different industrial, blah, blah, blah. You know, all these things inside the acting world in Kansas City.
Cool.
And I think that is what was attractive about me, was that innocence that I approached the roles with.
Interesting. Yeah. We just met. You have very expressive eyes. I mean, you don't seem like, I don't know, maybe you have a poker face. You don't strike me as someone who does.
No, I'm just being real.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what this whole thing is about. That's why I think the film is so great.
Yeah. No, it comes through in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like when I came in here today, I felt like I'd met you before, but you know, but I had it. It comes and goes in like 2 seconds in passing. You mention that your first introduction to working in restaurants was in college.
Yeah.
What did you go to college for theater? What did you go to school for?
Yeah, I went for theater, but you know, I didn't do a good job of it. I didn't apply for classes early enough. I didn't get any acting classes.
Mm-hmm.
I was working to pay for college.
Kitchens or front of house?
Kitchens.
Okay.
And you know, just this classic bar, wings, burgers, potato skins, you know, frying it up.
Yep.
And dishwashing. My first role was washing dishes, you know, and I just love the people.
Yeah.
The people were great. They were down, just down to earth people, a lot of fun, partying. We're partying, having a great time. It's just this classic college bar.
Yeah.
You ever seen the movie Waiting? It's like that.
I've never seen that movie.
Oh, man. It's that movie.
Yeah.
You know, that was the first place that I worked.
Now, you were around the music scene as a really young kid.
Yeah.
But was, you know, a lot of people transition from music to cooking.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of real good reasons why it happens.
The hours work great.
The hours, it's expressive.
Yeah.
It's, if you've played in a band, there's a real similarity between that and the dynamic of a kitchen.
Yeah.
You know? Did you feel at all, I mean, again, you were a little kid when you were a bar baby.
Yeah.
But did you feel just sort of innate a comfort in the environment of a kitchen from having spent a lot of time around bars and clubs and places like that?
For sure. You also, did. The work was very straightforward.
Right.
You know, it just do this, do that. The instant gratification, I think, is another big part of it. And it was just easy. It was great.
You took to it pretty well.
Very, very naturally, super naturally. And then I also had a friend who, when I moved back to Kansas City, because I kept getting calls, you know, while I was at college, we want you to come. Mm-hmm. Can you do this role? And it was in Kansas City. And, you know, and I was in Columbia, Missouri. And so I was just like, oh, you know, I'm off at college. I can't do the role, you know. And then I'm not getting any acting class. And I said, I got to get out of here, man. I got to go back to Kansas City. I got people who want me to be in roles, and I'm missing out on everything I should be doing right now. Why am I going to school to learn how to do this when there's professionals who are asking me to do the shows right now?
Yeah.
So, you know, let's just go back and do this. So my buddy, when I moved back there, he was cooking. And I was just like, well, you know, you're the same age as I am, and you don't have any training either, so why can't I do this?
Yeah.
And that was it, you know. And then the people at the restaurants that I worked at were so great. You know, you could work in the morning when you had rehearsals during the night, and when you had matinees, you could work at night. So it was a great balance, you know. And I'm not the type of person who can really sit and do nothing or just like I got to have a job. I got to be going. I got to move forward. And I also don't want to, I've been really lucky to have the example of someone who did what they love their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, that is lucky. Take a job with someone who turns you on to, there's so many people around your age who, not even around your age, it's like a 20-year span of people for whom the French Laundry cookbook, like, casts a spell, right?
It did that same thing for
you. It was like someone opens this up and it's like you're like through the looking glass. Can you just speak for a minute to this? Because you describe in the movie that you'd never, this was like a whole different world from what you'd seen.
Yeah, I mean, this is a world away from wings and burgers.
Yeah.
And, I just wanted to do a little more. And so I walked, there was a restaurant behind where I was working called the Grand Street Cafe. And I just, I had been walking around trying to elevate where I was working in Kansas City, trying to move up to the next level of cooking. But, I'm giving everybody a resume, I'm giving everyone an application,
mm-hmm.
not a resume.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept getting rejected. We'll call. Don't call us. We'll call you. And
right.
I finally walked into this place, and I got to talk to the chef. And that was it. His name was Michael Magliano. And a really special thing is he's actually in the film.
Yeah.
All the images.
That was actually him.
That
I was wondering
him.
That.
Yeah. And
so, how long ago was the moment that we see?
How
the moment that you guys kind of reenact. Of you, he's like like julienne, yeah. And you guys are looking at a book.
When was that?
Yeah,
that was in 2003.
So okay,
yeah, along 2003, 2004.
Okay. Yeah. That's the only reason I was wondering if it was actually him in the film because I'm like, this has to be.
He happened to be in Los Angeles at that time,
yeah.
And I just reached out to him. I said, "Hey, man, I'm doing this thing," and. They asked me to fly to Los Angeles to do just a little bit more because we didn't get all the they didn't get all the stuff all the footage that we needed or we thought we got everything we could get we squeezed these 3 days in Copenhagen dry worked so long
many
hours a day
.
And it was a joy the entire time. I can't state that enough.
Mm-hmm.
It was a joy the entire time. And then after they had done like a rough edit, Federico had done a rough edit, he said, we just need a little bit more. And so they brought me out to Los Angeles. Mike was there, and it just totally worked out. He came, and we, once again, you put us in the same room, and we're going to start firing on all cylinders together. And
mm-hmm.
that's what happened inside of this this space.
Yeah.
Where we were shooting the film in Los Angeles or right outside Los Angeles in a friend of mine's kitchen.
Yeah.
And man, it just when I went to Grand Street, he brought me back. We sat down. We talked for a little bit. I didn't even understand what a stage was, but he offered me a stage for a day. He said, come, we'll work together. And I was like, do you want me to quit my other job? Because I'll quit my other job. And he's like, no, I'm just trying to see how you work. And I didn't understand. I didn't understand that I didn't have the job already. So when I walked in, I was like, setting up my shop here, getting ready to I was ready to be there.
Yeah.
And he's just a really inspiring man. He is a natural mentor.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he put his arm around me and walked me through the steps of what it meant to work in a kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and got me excited. And then he went to another restaurant in Kansas City called The American. I had an opportunity to either stay where I was at the Grand Street or to go to the American and work there. And, I was sitting there with my mom in our kitchen and trying to make this decision of what I was going to do.
Yeah.
Because, one place is offering you more money to stay and the other one's giving you the opportunity to, grow and do more and work mm-hmm. on a higher level in Kansas City. But both restaurants were great. And I just said to her, I really feel like this guy's going to take me places. I'm going to go with Michael to the American. And just one of those crossroads that you take,
mm-hmm.
and it really made all the difference in the world.
So how long were you guys together all in?
He left in 2004 to go to the French Laundry.
Okay.
Late 2004. He mm-hmm. got an opportunity to, you know, he got an opportunity and showed me where he was going, and, you know, showed me the book and told me about this guy and the legend of that was Chef Keller at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the things you would expect. You know, he never had a culinary school education.
Yeah.
Found this place, this place in Napa Valley, yeah. and built it into this great restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just said, well, I'm going to get there. Give me a year. I'm going to get my skills up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was it, pretty much.
Okay. And this was only 4 or 5 years out from the publication of that book. So it was still pretty...
It was pretty fresh.
Pretty fresh.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was still huge.
And they were... I had no idea what rankings were, but I think they were at number 1, 50 best that year, like 2004 or 2005 and 3, you know, it's all those sorts of things, you know, but who are we to be ranked and this and that and the other, but you know, to some it's very important.
Oh yeah, and I mean, sitting where you were sitting and looking across, you know, to California and thinking about this place, that would have just made it all the more. You just mentioned your mom again.
Yeah.
Okay. The movie's mostly about you and your dad.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me a little about your mom?
Oh, man, she's great.
What's her name?
Linda Abel.
Okay.
Linda Irwin Abel.
Where's she from?
She's from Carthage, Missouri. And, you know, she really made their relationship happen. My father, where he achieved most of his fame and acclaim was with his first wife. Her name was Betty Miller.
Mm-hmm.
They were a piano and bass duo from the time he got out of the Army in the 50s, he was just supposed to go to Kansas City for 3 days, just be there for 3 days, and then he was going to go back home to Philadelphia. My dad's from Philadelphia.
Oh, really? So is mine.
Oh, really? Yeah. It's a great place. And but he got taken away to the Army because he's stationed in Fort Leonard Wood. Came to Kansas City, supposed to be there for 3 days, but everybody's like, oh, you got to meet this woman. You got to meet this woman, Betty Miller. Got to meet this woman. She's hotness. She's the hotness. She's the hotness on the piano right now. She was it. She was just tearing it up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to her music, you can hear it, man. She was incredible. They started working together, and then they fell in love, and then they were the premier group in Kansas City for the 60s, 70s. Toured around, played in New York, wow. Las Vegas, California, but predominantly in Kansas City, out of their own decision to just, that's where they were going to be. They held court at a place called the Golden Horseshoe for 15 years. It was a piano bar. People would come to see them. The type of place where you're there, you're drinking, you're having a good time, but when they're playing, you're listening.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really the spot. A really incredible place. And all of Kansas City were in love with Betty and Milt. Everyone. And my mother used to come up on the weekends to listen to them play. She loved them both dearly.
Mm-hmm.
Betty died in 1977 of stomach cancer. And she had a rather, I don't know exactly, but what I can imagine is a public decline. You know, she wanted to play till the day she died.
Mm.
So everyone watched her fade. And including my mother. And she just had this feeling that she was going to be the one to take care of my father because he was going to need that care after losing Betty.
Sure.
25 years of marriage, on stage, a very public love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you connect on multiple levels, it's just extremely deep.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like...
Yeah, there's no sanctuary.
No, man, it's everything. They are your being.
Yeah, you can't throw yourself in your work as an escape because that was your work also. Yeah,
exactly right. Yeah, everything is you and her.
Yep.
My mother wrote my father a letter expressing her deep, deep sorrow for the loss of Betty. And I can't remember the timeline, but not long after she called him and asked him, because he had the white pages then. So she said, she gave him some time and where are you playing? I think it was a couple of years. It was 1979. Yeah, she died in 77, around 79.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you playing tonight? Oh, I'm playing here. I'll save a table next to you, next to the bandstand for you. And he somehow made the connection that she was the one who wrote this letter.
Mm.
They went out after the gig, and all Dad did was talk about Betty. And she didn't find this out for a while, but that happened to be their wedding anniversary out on. I mean, this is storybook stuff. She continued to pursue my father, and she just made it happen. That was it. And, you know, my mom came in on her birthday. Dad came off the bandstand one night. They embraced. He came off a break. He went back on and he played "You Are the Sunshine of My Life."
Mm.
And that was the beginning of the beginning.
Oh my. Well, that's, yeah. Talk about storybook.
That's it, man. They were married in 80. I came around in 83.
Okay.
Betty had a child from a previous marriage. Her name is Betty Jo Miller. Fantastic player. Another musician, just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So Dad thought he couldn't have children. So in 83, 3 years after they were married, I was the biggest surprise in the world.
Wow.
And everyone was so delighted.
Mm-hmm.
And when my sister came along in 89, that was another huge surprise. My mother was just the greatest advocate I could ever have in my life for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
When I was like two things. When I was very young, we were watching a documentary on Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
And I looked at my mother. I think I'm three or four or something. Very young. Very yeah. young. You know, Mom, I want to be famous like Charlie Parker. And my mother looked at me and said, "Milton, you're already famous." And I think those are really strong words to say to a child. You know, you don't have to be anything. You are already something.
Mm-hmm.
And that sticks with me.
Yeah.
My mother was listening to one of Betty and Milt's albums, and she began to cry. And I asked her, you know, why did Betty have to die? And something that my mom said to me that she doesn't know if it was too tough or what it was, but she said, so you could be born.
Mm.
And both of those answers are, first of all, powerful, but second of all, encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
You are something, and you are here to be something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what type of woman she was.
Well, in my mind, there's like a dotted line back from that to the first thing we talked about, which was this royal name that she gave you.
It's just, I would be nowhere without her.
Hmm.
She deserves her own film.
Paris Gourmet delivers the finest specialty imported and local foods directly to chefs. For over 35 years, Paris Gourmet has sourced specialty foods from around the world. Their Meadowlands headquarters services the New York tri-state area. Paris Gourmet delivers Burmont butters, Cacao Noel chocolates, Ravi fruit purees, Cuisine Tech ingredients, and Bon Pâtissier viennoiserie to your kitchen. Paris Gourmet brings the world to your doorstep. They're close when professionals need them most. Learn more at parisgourmet.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Diane Stemple.
And I'm Elena Santigade, and we're the hosts of Cutting the Curd here on Heritage Radio Network. Featuring interviews with makers and mongers and everybody in between, this show is a downright funky look at the world of artisan cheese.
You can find Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I will get you back to the rest of my interview with Milton Abel II in just a moment. But first, Caitlin, I do need to just mention there are links to all of these things I'm about to mention in the bio of my Instagram feed for this show. The handle is @chefpodcast. First of all, in less than 2 weeks, on Monday, May 20th, I will be attending and participating in the LA Chef Conference.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second year they're doing this conference, but it's the first year that it's been part of the LA Food Bowl, which is a month-long series of events. The lineup, as I have mentioned previously on this show, is spectacular. And I will be doing a panel based on Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. It's an all-star panel. Barbara Lazaroff, co-creator of Spago and other restaurants. Susan Feniger, one half of the Border Grill restaurant team, along with her partner Mary Sue Milliken. The legendary chef John Sedler. Anyone in L.A. will probably know that name. Russ Parsons, formerly of the Los Angeles Times. And Michael McCarty, who just celebrated the 40th anniversary of Michael's. So again, you can link to the event and get tickets via the bio on our Instagram feed. I also just want to mention, Caitlin, speaking of the 90s or the past, I wrote an article recently for Taste Magazine. They did a 90s, they call it an issue, even though it's strictly an online publication, a 90s issue. And they asked me if I wanted to contribute. I've been having a lot of fun writing there. And I wrote a piece about the chef cookbooks of the 1990s, which you're kind of smiling as I say this, but we were both around for this.
Yeah, it was a big part of my career.
You were a PR person at the time in a publishing house. Mm-hmm. But the 90s were the time when these sort of giant, monolithic, in a lot of ways, vanity projects for chefs.
Yeah.
$50 books even back then.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't make much money or any money. A lot of them lost money. But I wrote a piece sort of examining that phenomenon. That piece is available on tastecooking.com. And I think it's an interesting read because, you know, chefs can still publish cookbooks, but the type of cookbook that I'm talking about in that piece, which, you know, the more recent examples would be things like maybe Sean Brock's cookbook or the Man Raisa cookbook that David Kinch did. They're few and far between today. It's very hard for people to sell those books, and with good reason, because a lot of them didn't make any money.
Yeah, but some of them are so lovely. And a lot of them, I mean, I worked on two of Jean-Georges' books. And yeah, I mean, there was beautiful photography and it was like a collector's item a lot. But, you know, the recipes are, they're kind of a treasure because a lot of them aren't, he doesn't make them anymore. And it's,
that's a good point.
And so it's kind of a, I don't want to say keepsake because that sounds really old fashioned, but I'm happy I have them. And I liked that period of publishing.
Well, that's a great point because that's one of the defining things about cooking, right? It's there for the moment. It's eaten. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And those dishes, like you said, they're gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they're on a menu somewhere in a file or mentioned in a review,
mm-hmm.
but that's it. So these books do capture a moment in time. I remember very distinctly David Kinch saying to me that when he did the Man Raisa cookbook, by the time the book was published, because it takes about a year to do the production and everything after you write it, that he had already moved on from a lot of food in the book. You mm-hmm. know, it was already a memory,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean,
and if you look at the Union Square cookbook, right? That, yeah. The Union Square was such a, you know, happening place. One of the, anyways, it was just kind of this incredible location.
Yeah.
And then they did that book around it, and now it's at a new location.
Right.
So all of those kind of memories of that experience of that building were captured in that book.
Yeah. Well, I'm convinced whether they know it or not, the main reason chefs want to do books is because of the ephemeral nature of what they do. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not like writing. It's not like painting. It's not like filmmaking. What chefs do is here and it's gone. Mm-hmm. And cookbooks are one of the few sort of shots at immortality that chefs have.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly. Anyway, wanted to mention all that to you guys. And with that, I'm going to return it now. And again, apologies for the way I sound. There is absolutely, Caitlin will tell you, I'm doing everything I can to moderate this sound as I sit here talking. But these allergies are just insane.
You're covered with a layer of green.
Meaning pollen.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the pollen.
Jeez. Okay. Here you go. I'm now going to return you to the rest of my interview with Milton Abel II. I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
I don't know that it was even mentioned in the movie. If it was, it went by me. You just mentioned a few minutes ago he was in the Army.
Yeah.
How did that experience, if at all, find its way into your upbringing?
Well, not too much.
Okay.
I mean, we were always yes, sir, no, sir.
But it would have been that way.
anyway, because that's just Midwestern values.
Yeah, right.
And I think Daddy just went into the Army because that's just something you did at that time.
Yeah.
And maybe it was being an African American in that time as well. Maybe it was, you know, I think he was one of 12 or 13 or 14 children. It's a big family, big family. And and they were all, and many of the able men were all in the Army or in the Navy or in the, you know, and so, you know, I think it was just something a part of how they came up.
Yeah.
And for us, there was no military type of expectation or anything like that. It was just good old Midwestern values, and that's it. I mean,
so your work ethic, all that—that would have been the case regardless.
No matter what, because they were working so hard.
Yeah, right.
You know, they were working so hard. I mean, my mother was my father's manager.
Okay,
she would iron all of his shirts.
Uh-huh.
She kept him looking sharp. We walked out of the door looking so sharp all the time. You know, and all of our clothes were always clean. I went to a school where we had uniforms from fifth grade, from kindergarten until fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And my shirts were always pressed. My pants were always clean. My uniforms were always tight. Mm-hmm. And that just gives you a certain amount of confidence.
Oh, yeah.
Going out the
door. Did you
have
to wear a tie?
Every day. Yeah, tie, badges, you know, as student excellence, blah, 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 red sweaters, all that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I you could call it military, but we were just...
Oh yeah, I'm not trying to force an. I just it was something I didn't know until you said it. I don't think, is it in the film? I don't think it's mentioned.
I don't think so either. Yeah. But out of that, I mean, came everything. You know, he met Tommy Flanagan in the Army, who's one of the great jazz legends, and it took him to Kansas City. I mean, none of this would have happened if he hadn't been transferred to the Fifth Army Band.
Life is amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
I think about how I got to Copenhagen and all the decisions I did to get there.
Sure.
And, you know, you just make one different decision at the crossroads and your whole life has changed.
Totally.
It's the same thing with this film, you know. There's supposed to be these very few times in my life when I've said, you need to do this. This is the right decision. You have to do this.
Yeah.
And I'm standing in this cold place, construction site, all the stress in the world to open up. And got to get this bakery open. Got to get this coffee roastery open. Got to do it. We're so behind. Oh, let's take 3 days out and make this film.
Yeah.
You got to do it.
Yeah.
I said, this is an opportunity. I'm going to do this.
Yeah. So can we talk about the French Laundry for a minute?
Let's do it.
You get there.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I'm not spoiling anything because I don't really think it's... How did you... That's a coveted assignment for a cook, right?
Yeah.
Probably even more so back then, because there are more restaurants now that are perceived to be at a similar level in this country, right?
Yes.
So at that time, how'd you make it happen?
I gave Michael gave me Chef Keller's email.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to tell anybody else to do this, but I got it and I wrote him. At that time, I just wrote him an email.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm Milton Abel. I know Michael Magliano. Dropped his name so many times. I know Michael Magliano.
Yeah.
I don't have a culinary school education, but I understand that's similar to you. I'll sweep the floor. I'll clean the toilet. I'll work in the garden. I'll do whatever it takes, but I want to be a part of your restaurant. And I did that once a month for about 3 months, trying not to annoy, but trying to show persistence.
Right. And respectably persistent.
There you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got a stack of resumes that are as tall as, you know, whatever on your desk. Mm-hmm. You got to kind of maybe put your resume in there a few times to make it go to the top of the stack. So I figured eventually he would either get, you know, annoyed and tell me to stop, or he would say, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And... So Michael told me, he texted me, he said, Chef Keller asked about you today. And I was like, oh, you know, then I was like, okay, maybe
this
something.
Was after like three or four.
Three months. And I was like, oh, well, maybe something will happen. And then I got a call from a woman named Xing Chin, who was the sous chef on pastry at that time. They had no pastry chef at that time. And they asked me to come out and do a stage. I had actually, I had a reservation to eat at the restaurant with a friend of mine. She was moving to San Francisco, and she needed somebody to help drive with her across the country. Mm-hmm. And I had agreed, and we were going to finish the trip by going to French Laundry, eating, seeing Michael, because we both worked with him at the time, and then I was going to fly back. Just, she needed help driving. You can't drive across the country like that by yourself. So we loaded up in her Honda Prelude. I've got my knees in the dashboard because her whole life is in this thing. Mm-hmm. And we just drove cross country. And it just, when they called me for the stage, I was like, oh man, I'm going to happen to be there during this time.
To be in the neighborhood.
Perfect.
Right.
So we just did it.
Yeah.
And then when I flew back, so I ate the night before. Mm-hmm. And that was just a fantastic experience. Man, we had a 9 o'clock reservation, but they knew that I was coming to stage the next day and that I was going to start at 5:30. They had a cancellation at 7:15 and they welcomed me in at 7:15. We walk in the door. There's a gentleman named Larry Nadeau, who's a legend there.
I know Larry.
And, you know.
He was maitre d' technically.
Yeah, maitre d'.
But he was there almost from the very beginning.
From the very beginning. Yeah. And you know how, Chris Carter, the great wide receiver. He's not the tallest man in the entire world. He's not maybe the fastest athlete in the entire world, but he has the biggest hands. And that just means, you're going to be a wide receiver, right? Mm-hmm. This is perfect for you. Larry Nadeau was like born to be a maitre d'. The man has the biggest hands. His handshake is so powerful.
Yeah.
And his demeanor is so thoughtful and caring and mm-hmm. Just the same thing. I don't know you, but I feel like I'm a part of your family. You're welcoming me into this restaurant.
Sorry to interrupt for 1 second, but Larry Nadeau, what was amazing to me about him is that the French Laundry for a lot of people can be a very intimidating place to come eat. It's almost like going to the White House. And Larry was expert at popping that balloon and trying to get people, because he was such an everyman. He wasn't one of these haughty fine dining people. We both know what I mean by that.
Exactly.
There are these
right.
guys who put on such airs when they work at some restaurants. Larry was he was like the guy next door working at the French Laundry, and he just like set you at ease. He made people able to enjoy, people who weren't used to eating like that, the ones who were making these pilgrimages, the ones who were spending the money they had to do that meal like that once a year. He made them feel comfortable.
You've been waiting for this for 3 months.
Yes.
You've made the reservation. You built it up in your brain. You don't want to make a mistake or this
right.
and that.
Am as I a diner.
Do the, as
right.
a diner.
As someone paying a fortune.
Exactly right.
But he understood all that.
The first thing he said to me was, "Hello, Mr. Abel. How are you?
Yeah.
We're going to treat you really nice before we put you to work tomorrow." And that just said so much.
Yes,
I expected to walk in and be like, "Abel, party of two, thank you."
He's not at that restaurant anymore.
No, not anymore.
He's a special guy. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt your story.
But he deserved that time to be spoken about.
Thank you. Thank you.
And he did the same thing, man. I mean, me and this woman are looking at, well, first of all, the table when we walk in. There's very few empty tables there because they're going through the trend. 7:15, so not the whole dining room's not sat yet. I see a table with two champagne flutes on it. I was like, we're sitting there. Are we going to go sit there? Yes, we're sitting there. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We're looking at this book of a wine list. You have no idea what we're doing.
Yeah.
And, they just take that. Well, you can see our eyes are just like, what is, I don't speak French. that sort of thing. And, he just takes that book out of our hands and says, we'd really like to treat you to the wine pairing this evening. Just that exact same thing, just disarming you, making and controlling how much you drink as well, because in a way that's really positive, because I got to work tomorrow and you could easily be overwhelmed by the experience and just get lost in the evening. And forget how important tomorrow is.
I needed like an IV after the first time I ate there. I couldn't, bed with like 3 bottles of water.
The food overload is enough as well. I mean, just that. And it was just a fantastic experience. And then the stage was, after that, I felt like these people were taking care of me, and I feel comfortable, and I just was able to do what I did, I just do what you do.
Yeah.
That's it. Just show up and do what you do. So I showed up at 5:30 in the morning. I actually worked all day. They kept telling me to go home, and I kept telling them, I only got one day. I'll be here. And then, now we're just going to clean down. You can, you know, you're welcome to go anytime you want. No, no, I'll clean down with you. And I stayed until I got there at the beginning and I left at the end of mm-hmm. the day. And that was really important to me because I only had one day before my flight sure. was the next day.
Did you feel comfortable there?
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope this doesn't come off the wrong way. You kind of fit the pro. I always say Keller hires like G-men.
Yeah.
You know, clean cut. You don't see a lot of facial hair in those restaurants.
You're not allowed to.
Oh, I didn't even know that officially.
You come as you are. You stay as you came. You stay as you're hired.
Yeah.
You know, and when I think it's important for you to have a certain level of, grooming, whatever it
no,
may
but
be.
No, but that's, you kind of fit the profile of like a Keller chef, cook.
And I mean, appreciate that.
I mean, but I could, you kind of, you do. If you look at people who've worked there over the years, it's like, I always say like tennis umpires, it's the same thing. You're not there to call attention to yourself, to be a showboater, none of that.
No,
none of it.
You keep it tight.
Yeah.
And you, I mean, you showboat by what you do every day.
Yeah. Right. So this is it's interesting to me that you gravitated toward pastry because, you know, again, you had this musical background, not just your family, but you yourself, right? To me, if you're going to pick one or the other, right, which savory or pastry, which one allows, this is to me, maybe you're about to correct me, but I think most people would say, if you were to say which one allows for more spontaneity, which one allows for more, for example, they change the savory menu French Laundry every day. The cooks, for people who don't know, the cooks sit around after service the night before. They have lists of all the what's available, produce, proteins, or what's coming in,
and the farm,
which is, well, they call it the garden, but it's their own farm across the street. They have relationships with, what is it, Jacobson's Orchard?
Yeah, Peter Jacobson's Orchard.
Yeah, like the local orchards and whatnot. But they sit around, the cooks sit around. It's like an academy. Oh. They sit around and they write with the chef the menu for the next day, right?
It's really important because it's your section.
Right.
It's your dishes. You're not cooking someone else's food.
Yes.
It's you know, you have that sense of ownership, which is extremely important every day. And also it's extremely important not to do the same thing every day as well. You just get so, I mean, with talent of that level, you'll just get so bored. I mean, they'd get so bored if they had to cook the same
sure.
thing every day.
So, but on the
pastry.
How does it work for the pastry department, though? Because you can't be, they're, like, dishes get invented, and cooks don't like the word invented.
Yeah.
Dishes get conceived.
Yeah.
In those meetings at the end of service,
yeah.
Pastry's not quite like, you can't be that improvisational.
It's a production. You know, you've got ice creams to produce that
right.
take, you know, that need to rest for 24 hours. You've
yeah.
got, you know, different, you're making cakes and this and that. And the other. It just doesn't happen in one day. It takes preparation and it takes multiple days of preparation. So,
yeah.
you know, that menu changes less frequently. But if we had some friends coming into the restaurant, we would do some dishes for them. Something that like, oh, I've only got this much of this, so I'll do it like that. You know, when you get down to the end of the strawberry season
yep.
in the garden, you only got so many, so
yeah.
we can't put that on the menu, so we'll just do 10 tonight or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And, you know, that was our opportunity in pastry to be dynamic every day, you know, and with our cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, when I first started, I needed recipes. I had no culinary school education. I had no training. I couldn't just riff on this or that or the
sure.
other. Couldn't cook a piece of meat to temp.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, not consistently,
yeah.
of course.
Not
I could,
to the standard
but
of
no,
a place like that.
God, no.
Yeah.
No way. And I had always done pastry before in the other places that I worked because all the preparation was before service.
Mm-hmm.
Everything during service was plating. While
yeah.
it was pressure time, you know, that was pretty simple. You know, not simple, but it was just very straightforward.
Yeah.
You do the dish like this.
Mm-hmm.
The recipe is like this. So many grams of that, so many grams of that.
Mm-hmm.
And a technique that could be written down and shown and was very precise and exact. And that's what I needed to be successful in the kitchen.
Mm.
And now it's... that's the beauty of it for me.
You, in the film, say that you sat. This was a breathtaking statement to me. That you sat down with Chef Keller, and told him you wanted to be the pastry chef of the French Laundry.
Well, we were. I was leaving Per Se, and going to go work in Europe at Noma, And before I left, you know, I had been working for this man for 7 years at that point, seven years. Between French Laundry and Perse.
Got it. This wasn't clear. Okay, this wasn't clear. Yeah, that it was at that point.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I just wanted to make sure it was very clear to him that I was leaving in order to come back.
Mm.
This was my goal. This is what I wanted to do. And if you this opportunity arose, I really want this. And if you give me that, if you see it fit, I would love for you to give me that opportunity.
Mm.
And that's where that came from. It's not, nobody just sits down with him and tells him, I'm going to do this.
I didn't take it that way. Yeah, but a lot of people would be too sort of intimidated to even make that kind of a... I've seen people like who work there. I've seen people like shake in his presence. Not that he's doing anything. He's just such a... Especially, again, you go back, you know... Yeah.
I worked with him.
You worked with him. You were there when he was still on the line.
He was just stepping out.
Yeah,
just stepping out.
Yeah.
And Chef Corey Lee was the chef de cuisine starting right after I started. I started in March, and Chef and Corey started just after that. And but I had been with him for so long. I mean, the first thing I ever did. In Chef Keller's presence was drop hot apple jam at his feet. Okay, I was making, trying to push and pushing and and I had made this jam and I, you know, consolidation is like a really important thing. Like you try to put something in a container as it exactly fits.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't have like 3 liters of something in a 5 liter. So in a 5 liter container.
Yeah.
So I had put like 2 liters of jam in a 1.9 liter container and was carrying this hot stuff like, by the rim to the walk-in to cool it.
Yeah.
And he opened the door for me, and he opened the door, and it hit me, and I dropped it right at his feet. Can you imagine? And so he just... we cleaned it up, and he... and we cleaned it up together, and he...
Together.
Yeah. And and he said he was... He apologized to me, like he opened the door to me. Like, no, Chef, I did this. I'm so sorry, blah, blah, blah. You know, so after that, everything was easy. I'm just... Right. You know, that's it. You know, it's just the most embarrassing moment.
You know, it's so funny, because when you'd say he helped, you know, he cleaned it up with you. I remember interviewing Drew Napurant once, the restaurateur here in New York, and he was telling me about Keller back in the days when he had Raquel.
Yeah.
And I said, what do you remember about... What do you... Like, if I just say, what do you remember about him back then? And Drew... They never worked together.
Yeah.
But Drew goes, cleaning.
Yeah.
You would drive past that restaurant at night after service, and he would be cleaning. He's good like that.
He's just the ultimate example.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
And if you're not going to follow anyone into battle if they're not racing in front of you and leading the charge. And that's just exactly how he is.
Can you talk to me about... I actually had Matt Orlando on the show.
Okay.
Not long ago.
He's a great friend.
We were at the Philly Chef Conference together like a month ago.
Yeah.
And he did the show. It was great.
Yeah.
But so can you just talk, A, a little bit about your experience there? And B... This phenomenon of all these people from elsewhere in Copenhagen, it's from outside, it seems pretty strange to me. And I don't mean that in a critical way. It's hard to figure out why.
Why is
it? I mean, you guys are all talented. You all have great resumes, but like, it's kind of crazy.
And how do you
especially given the history of America's reputation culinarily, right? This is 20 years ago. This is unimaginable.
You got Portuguese people and Irish people and just people from all over, all different countries working together in this international kitchen. We're in a different country that speaks a language that is so difficult, but we're all speaking English.
Yeah.
And you, I mean, what must you think as a diner coming there? Like everyone's speaking English. And you're like, why? It was the last guy. Why are you American? You're here. There's another American here. There's a guy from Germany. There's, you know, it just is this melting pot of people inside of this restaurant all coming together to work. Work inside of the walls of this, like, I don't even know this, like, trends. I don't want to say trend setting, but just this, like,
influential
forefront of the cuisine at that time, you know, and really creating and defining what the cuisine of in the North was at that time, you know, setting the standard, but also inventing them, you know. I mean, just what the standard or the parameters even were.
Sure.
And man, it was crazy. It was crazy. I showed up there with my bags. They were so kind that let me. I lived in the Nordic Food Lab in their basement of this houseboat right outside of Noma for the first 2 months I lived there, because, you know, trying to find a, can't exactly jump on Craigslist Copenhagen and you know, try to find a place to live. And so, you know, that was just out of control, staying in this houseboat. The houseboat had like a brass bathtub. You know, that was my bathroom. It's just like, just you know, no bed. Like, I had a bed, but it was like on the floor and just, you know. Everything was just so different, you know. And but I always say, if you have a place to live and you have a place to work, the transition is easy, because you just focus on those two things. Just focus on work, and you can do anything.
Yeah,
and you'll find friends through there, and you'll just grow, and everything will, it'll just fall into place after that.
Yeah,
you know, this is the first time I've worked in a European style kitchen where you both work lunch and dinner. We made everything every day, you know. Nothing was made. There was no, you know, in the laundry, like, you know, you have to make a cookie the day before, bake it, cool it, and then the next day you have to pour the mousse. And because we had no blast freezers, we had no way to like do things rapid fire. Yeah. Everything had to be planned and executed in a cycle, in a you know, in a succession.
Mm-hmm.
But this was like, man, I'm like, pureeing sorrel with and juice and apples, and then putting the two together and season them with malic acid. What the hell is that? And salt. And, you know, that I didn't use any sugar for what I, you know. And we're making this ice disc with a blast freezer, and we're using the PacoJet, and I had always used a churning machine before that. And you know, it's you know, you're those onions are burning. Those onions are burning over there. Those are, oh, that's how it's supposed to be. You know, that's sort
of thing. Was it crazy to you that you could come from French Laundry and per se, and go to any kitchen and have it be that sort of? I don't know if this is the right word. It sounds like it. Maybe it is, but a little disorienting.
Oh man, for sure.
Was that like stunning? Was it stunning to you, or were you mentally prepared for that?
No, I was mentally prepared for that. Yeah. I knew that this was going to be difficult. But I mean, even going from French Laundry to per se, it was, you know, at French Laundry, I was running around. You know, not running around. Actually, that was the most calculated and easiest transition I had had. I think also because I was so naive, and I had no, and people were so kind and really gearing me up and building me up and creating me, allowing me to be just a commis, which is the most basic level of the kitchen, and then transition into the demi chef de partie very easily. And you know, my chefs were tough. Claire Clark, she was a tough chef, but she was fair and she was excellent, and she made, and all the people were surrounding me, Courtney Schmidig and Shing, and all these people who I worked with, Janine Wiseman, Greg Moscow, all these guys, we were just a great team. So nobody let anybody fall down. When I moved to per se, you know, Elwin Boyles was the pastry chef. Once again, very tough, but fair, demanding, strong. But I felt every day it was so much bigger. And I felt for the first part, and even towards the end, I felt every day like I wasn't going to make it. I wasn't going to make it. My section was so busy. I like bore a hole into this area where I stood between the oven and the stove and my cooler, that I just felt like I just spun around in all day, you know, moving, moving, moving. And every day I didn't know if I was going to make it for service, because I had so much to do. But every day I made it, and that was a great feeling. And so I expected to feel that way when I went to Noma. It's going to be totally different. Get ready. It's going to take everything you have inside of you to you have nothing to fall back on. This is nothing like what you've done before.
Right.
And get ready to have that similar feeling of, are you going to make it every single day? Do you know what you're doing? Do you know, you know, it just was thrilling.
Do you ever miss that element? I mean, you've got your own business now.
Yeah, I'm a partner with two other people. Yeah, and
go ahead.
I feel the same way.
You feel the same way?
Oh, man. Where, you know, croissants is we do a lot of croissants, and it's a bakery, you know, a bakery and a coffee roastery, and it's that symmetry that we like, you know, great, amazing coffee, made with such care and concern and attention to detail, amazing pastries, made in a similar fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you every morning when you come in at 5 a.m, you've set this proofer with all of your work from the day before inside.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel it. You think, oh, these are going to be fine. These are going to be good. Everything looks
right.
good. But I show up in the morning at 5 a.m, I open that proofer for the first time, and I'm like, oh, everything's okay.
The same thing as like people perform, even seasoned performers will tell you they have butterflies before they go on 100%. Stage? Is it the same thing?
It's because you care.
Yes.
If you care,
yeah.
No matter how many times you've done something, you're always going to have that feeling.
Yeah.
Because if it goes wrong, it hurts you so bad. You know, you've disappointed people. Somebody's coming, even to the bakery. Somebody's coming to have, it's either, whether it's the person who is their destination spot,
yeah.
who heard about it because someone at NoMa told them to come and you got to try these baked goods. And if it's not there or it's not on point, you've disappointed them.
Right.
Or even to the guy or the lady who this is their morning stop.
Yeah.
And they always come and do this yes. every single day, and this is their office, and they sit here on the Wi-Fi, and they have a great cappuccino and a great croissant, and you've disappointed them because they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
It's both sides, you know. Yeah. And I really actually want to serve both sets of people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Sure.
The day-to-day and the destination.
Sure. You said earlier when I said it in passing, the name of the... It's Anderson and Maillard.
Yeah.
Can you, first of all, you'll do a better job than I will.
This
is kind of my kind of Achilles heel is science. But can you just, Maillard is what? What is that? Most people listening to this are cooks and chefs, so they probably know. But what does that describe?
It's the name of the scientist who discovered the Browning reaction. And so for us, all of the caramelization flavor comes from that caramelization in the croissants,
mm-hmm.
in the bread. We break our bread pretty dark.
Mm-hmm.
In the Queen Amon, especially in the Queen Amon, all the flavor is coming from that.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the coffee. And so those two, and Anderson is the last name of my partner.
Yes.
So actually some people think my last name is Maillard.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
but you said before, was it a conscious decision to, you didn't want to put your own name on the
shingle? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there. I joined the project super late.
Okay.
So they had already, you know, I was freelancing. I was trying to figure it out. I mean, this goes to what the film's all about. I'm trying to figure out a way to like, make this profession work with a family.
Yeah.
And in a restaurant, that's just really difficult.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that it's the restaurant's fault. I think it's my fault.
And really?
Yeah, man. And yeah, for sure, man.
But restaurant, we just met. I don't want to be rude. But I mean, restaurants are relationship killers.
It can be hard.
So, I know. I mean, I've got probably dozens of friends I know who couldn't sustain being a chef and being, you know, even forget kids, married. And I don't mean because of adultery. I just mean like because they were never around. They had nothing to give when they were around.
And we do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
I blame myself. Okay. Like the reason I left the French Laundry, when I got the opportunity to go back as the head pastry chef, I spent that for 2 years. You know, I signed the contracts to go back. Chef Keller gave me the opportunity to come back. And once the opening arose, when Courtney Schmidig decided to leave,
mm-hmm.
they called me and they gave me the offer to be the head pastry chef there. And I signed the contract 6 months ahead of time. And then I met my wife 1 month after I signed those contracts.
Of course. How else would that have happened?
Oh, you know, yeah, of course. And so I didn't meet anyone in Copenhagen that whole damn time.
Right.
And then it happens right then. And, you know, that's just how it works. So then we, you know, we started falling in love. We did fall in love. And then we were just going to do it long distance. She was going to move over. She was done with her PhD. She's going to move over. It's time. This is about 2 years into my tenure there. And I had planned to stay there for 5 years minimum.
Mm-hmm.
It's the greatest job of my life. Maybe I will never leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this organization is fantastic. It's the pinnacle. It's the top of the top. Mm-hmm. Why would I change anything?
Mm-hmm.
But then I just... Chef Keller told me that we were going to close the restaurant to do the remodel.
Mm.
And I had this fear that if I bring this woman over, this woman comes over to be with me, and I'm so in love with this restaurant and this opportunity that I just wouldn't be able to have both, and I wouldn't be able to sustain both. Not because of the restaurant. They love me. They've done everything for me. That Chef Keller had done so much for me in my life up to that point. And he did even more by allowing me to go when I told him that I needed to go because this woman was so important to me. I just knew I couldn't do both.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew I couldn't do both. And that was even, and then when I went to a mass, I left, went with their blessing, left, went back to Copenhagen. I joined the team at a mass, you know, we're working there. And then we decided to have the kid. We started trying to have a child. We have Benjamin, our first child. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be gone during all his waking hours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was going to work early and leaving work late. On my own accord, you know, that's what I was doing.
Well, you didn't have another setting, right?
No, exactly. Yeah. This is what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And I was going to, anything I'm going to do, I've said that in the film, you know, anything I'm going to do, I'm going to do it all the way. Well, if you're going to say that about work, then you got to say that about being a father. So I left the restaurant there so I could try to find something that would make them both work. Because we're just, because my dad was always there.
Yeah.
Always there.
Amazingly.
Amazingly. Absolutely right. And my mom was always there. And that's why I am who I am. And that's why I am where I am. And I just had to do the same thing. So that's why this bakery
works.
Schedule works.
Yeah.
If I get up at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning, everybody's asleep. And if I get home, then I could get off by 3, pick the kids up, we can eat dinner together, and then we can go to bed. And but you know, man, with opening this second location, I'm doing it all over again to myself. I'm working too much, and I'm falling into that trap again. And I've got to like step back and stop and realize why I'm doing this and get back to the family. You know, it just is.
But do you not consider that a finite sort of spike, you know, until things get rolling and then.
And then, that's exactly right. But try to tell your wife that or try to tell your kids that.
Right.
You know, they don't care. What's important in front of them is exactly is what's happening right now. You know, we're just. And, you know, you got to trust me. I'm going to get there. But you could keep saying that.
Yeah,
you know, it could always be something.
Sure,
something can always happen. Something could always happen. Something would always happen.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's very understanding, but at the same time, she knows she needs to be tough on me so that I realize what's important and I get my shit together.
Are you, this is kind of a cliche, but it's very true of the business. Are you sort of an adrenaline junkie? Like,
oh man,
you are.
There's
something as grueling as your old life. Not very old, but. Yeah. There's a very knowing smile that just came across your face.
I love it.
But as grueling as that could be, it's like the Hurt Locker. People get addicted. It's like at the end of the Hurt. Do you ever see that movie?
Yeah, I saw it.
When he goes voluntarily goes back, and you know he's in the bomb suit again.
Exactly.
That's what cooks are like.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
I thrive on it. You know, I mean.
So isn't that the fear for you? It's almost like an addiction.
No, but absolutely. You're right. It could be an addiction for sure, but it also could just be a sense of pride. Like,
sure.
I did this. I can do this. I have done this. At the same time, you feel worth less because you're not still doing it.
Right. I get that. But I mean, when you talk about the fear of like, no, it's not just a spike, you know, getting the second place open. Yeah. What if I don't come back?
Yeah.
Right? I think the fear is that you'll get sucked back into that adrenaline groove.
I was trying to decide where to go next and what to do, what to open or this and that. And I used the phrase with one place I was considering, go out to pasture. And my wife just said to me, well, you're not going to enjoy that. You're already saying it in a negative light. Just wipe that option off the table right there, you know. And
so it's a very it's a very small needle that you're trying to thread.
Yeah.
And it seems like you kind of had, I don't know, it looks like from the film, sounds like sitting here with you, like you've come as close as, it seems like you're honing it.
Oh man, I'm doing it,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And that's the new challenge. Maybe that's the pressure. that's the bullets flying over your head is trying to navigate this and find what's going to make me happy. You know.
Yeah.
But I thrived in that atmosphere. There's a great documentary called Noma at Boiling Point, and it's Rene at his. At his realist, he's speaking Danish. It's a very long, long time ago, mm-hmm. long, long time ago, and I think he got a lot of flack from the Danish people. I think it was on Danish television mm-hmm. from them about like how he spoke to everybody and this and that and the other and blah blah blah. But you just don't understand the kitchen, or to me, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this documentary because I'm watching it before I go to start there to see what this person is all about, see what mm-hmm. the chef's all about, see what this restaurant's all about, and try to get a feel of what I'm about to walk into.
Yeah.
And man, after I finished watching it, I couldn't wait to be there.
Yeah, because you want to see if you can,
if can
you have
hang.
The stuff. Yeah, yeah,
exactly right. Totally. I was ready.
This is not an unusual mindset for a cook.
And it was just. I used the word earlier, and I don't think there's any better way to describe it. Thrilling.
Yeah. Well, I should probably let you go.
I think I have something else. Man, it's been such a whirlwind.
Too long.
No, it's been such a whirlwind. This has just been a fantastic experience, and I still, to this moment, and even sitting here with you right now, I know all the people you've interviewed in throughout your career, and I know the things that you've done and the things you've written.
Oh,
well. And I still just think to myself, who am I?
Oh,
who
please.
Am I? Who am I? Well, who am I?
Thank you.
And it's just really exciting to be here and sit down with you. And
well,
what a fantastic time in my life. And what a wonderful thing to leave for my children. I hope they listen to this when they're able to understand. And
I do
just
too.
Know how much I love them and know how excited I am to be going through this right now.
Well, I'm happy for the moment you're in.
Thank you.
I love the film. Again, it's that's my jazz. A title that has a lot of meaning, as everybody just learned over the last hour plus. Thanks for sitting with me. It was great to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Caitlin, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Milton Abel II. Thank you, Milton, for that time when you were on your whirlwind trip through New York. I love meeting you. I hope we will stay in touch, as we decided we would try to do after the interview. To Jeet Paul, our engineer at Heritage, thank you, Jeet, for splicing these things together. To the rest of the team at Heritage, thank you for your support, as always. To all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And a reminder, if you would like to keep up with the show, you can subscribe for free on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would leave us a rating or a review at the Apple's iTunes store, it does help people find the show. And we would really appreciate it. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.